Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2014. Lecture 1, delivered on August 18, 2014. The title of this lecture is Introduction to Finance.
Today, Introduction to Finance. You're stepping into a world of business that is not like business used to be. It's a perilous world, and finance is in the nexus of the problem. The corruption of the system has put us on the brink of catastrophe every day. We went over the edge just a little bit in 2008, and we saw the abyss. And then we said, nah, FTS, fancy that scenario, and we walked away from it. We hid. But all we did was paint over the pit with a nice pretty coat of paint. And it's still out there. And it's worse now than in 2008. We walk on a blade, and on both sides is a chasm. And I'm going to teach you a little bit about the traditions of finance, what we do at our heart, and then I will take you into the world of what we've done that is going to eventually lead to disaster. Fortunately, I'll be dead. It's your problem. So, look, finance is actually a branch of economics, specifically the economics of money, risk, and things like that. The book says finance is a combination of accounting and economics. No, finance has very little to do with accounting. Accountants do their thing, trifling that it is, and then we do our thing. We use accounting information, but we also have to understand that the accounting information doesn't help us much when we really need to get down to the brass tacks of decision-making based on financial models. So what we're going to do here in this course is take you through the way finance people think. And we'll do it old school. Apparently, I don't even have an eraser anymore because everyone's supposed to use that LED up there. Finance is a branch of economics. Specifically, we have in finance there are actually five different areas of finance. The book lists three, but there are five areas of finance. Do I have any finance majors in here? A few? Well, you might get jobs. At least you'll have a job before the marketing majors do. But no problem. There are five basic areas of finance. There is the one most people think of when they think of finance is actually investments. Investments, you know, stocks, bonds, buy, sell. I can even give you some really great financial advice. Here it is. Buy low, sell high. You might want to have that tattooed on your ass. Stocks, bonds, and all that kind of stuff. The old tradition, seeing those traders in the pits screaming and yelling and trying to trade with you, doesn't exist anymore. It's just gone. Now it's all in electronic blips. And really, investments is a matter of just letting the model, financial models, tell you what to do. There's very few traders really, especially at the level of the consumer level, they just let the financial models tell them what to buy and what to sell based on the analysis of the needs of the portfolio's owner and all that. That's investments, and we talk a lot about that in this class. Another deep area of finance, probably more at the heart and the core of finance, would be what we call financial management. or you'll hear me use a slightly older term. Financial management sounds fancy. This is corporate finance. You're inside a company, and you do the analysis of projects, whether or not they are worth taking on, whether or not the expected value of the future whether or not the expected value of the future cash flows is better than the money you're going to spend on it. So we have these marketing people, HR people, all these different people say, well, we got this great project we want you to have a look at, and we're the ones, the financial analysts, who say yes or no. It could be the greatest project in the world, but if it doesn't pass our test, which you'll learn how to do in this class, it is a no-go. It just goes out the door. Now, there are other areas, too. There's institutional finance. Now, interestingly enough, these two used to be completely separate fields. That was the result of a law that was passed in the wake of the Great Depression. It was called Glass-Steagall. Don't worry, I'll bring it up later and I'll write it on the board. But the Glass-Steagall Act made a wall so that banks, institutional and financial institutions like that, banks could not get involved in investments. There was a wall. Can't do it. You, over here on the institutional side, you take care of people's money in very safe, prudent, responsible ways. And even if there's something in your company somewhere that does investments, there can be no blending of these two. The incentives for protecting people's money in deposits must take precedence, and so you cannot have them playing with investments that might put those people's money at more risk than it should be in a bank. That's gone now. It was repealed in 1999, and all hell broke loose. Now, these two are basically, well, not basically, in many ways, they are one and the same. Although you would work on the institutional side or the investment side, there's a fluidity of information, of incentives, of deal-making across the two. Unfortunate, because that's part of the overall apocalyptic problem that is out there. Going on, there is real estate finance, which sounds boring as hell, but it's actually quite interesting. Well, I'm not talking about selling a duplex and all that kind of stuff. I'm talking about the finance of buildings, of apartment complexes, of shopping malls, of skyscrapers, of that kind of thing, that kind of real estate finance. Figuring out, well, what can we make off this property? What are we going to have to pay for it? What are the tax consequences? All that kind of stuff. And then figuring out whether it's a go or a no-go. And also dealing with things that are speculative. Like, for example, it's been in your lifetimes. Well, they were around before, but they've kind of come about in your lifetime. The enclosed mall is still thought of as the shopping mall. But there was a trend starting, well, like I said, it was before that, but it really picked up speed in the late 20th century, early 21st century, for these outdoor open malls. Like in Peoria, they've got that one. Here, they tore down an enclosed mall and put up the College Hills Mall as an outside mall. The question would be, is this a worthwhile project? Does this make more sense than indoor mall? What can we do with this that we couldn't do with the indoor mall? Are we going to make money if we do it this way with an outdoor mall as opposed to an indoor mall? That's one thing you would do in real estate finance. And then there's finally this one, financial planning. Well, there's going to be one more that I've got to bring up too. Financial planning. How do you take care of people's future needs? Woman, you are going to die someday. It will hurt like hell, and you'll bitch, and then finally you'll shut up and be dead. But before that, we're going to have to find a way to take care of you. There's going to be expenses in your old age. You know, your medicines, something for all those cats because he turned out into an old crazy cat lady. Stuff like that. So, and something to eat, you know, maybe. But The thing of it is, we got to prepare you for that. So on your lousy salary, we've got to figure out how to put aside enough, either you individually or through your company's pension plan, we've got to figure out how you can live into your old age. Someday, you are going to want to have your dream home, a double-wide trailer for your double-wide wife and her four kids from another marriage, and her brother who lives with you while he's between jobs. But he does make money. I mean, you know, the meth is actually a moneymaker. But the thing is, okay, we've got a plan. You want to be in this double wide in 5 years. That's your goal. So how are we going to get you to achieve this dream house of yours in out on the outskirts of Decatur starting now? How much do we have to set aside a month for the double wide, for the land that goes on, a couple of broken down trucks to put on the property, and something to set aside so you can feed the three dogs who have eight legs among the three of them? Living the dream. That's right. That's what Illinois State is all about. Damn it. We got to prepare you for what's coming down the road. And so financial planning is a hot field in finance. Realistically, we like managing the money of rich people more than middle class and poor people because they're rich. You know, I took my finance students up to J.P. Morgan, and some of our grads are up there, way up at the top, 55th floor of J.P. Morgan, managing wealth, doing wealth management for the richest of the rich in the world. The one guy, just sitting back, he said, "Yeah, you got less than $30 million. We're really not interested in talking to you here. Well, what's your average family wealth that you're managing? $600 million. What? So, you know, they're doing it because these are rich people. They have problems too. They have needs. And they've got the money to have people take care of their needs. And among those needs are financial management, making sure that there's always money available for whatever they want to do, making sure that there's enough money for things like, oh, we want to take a 2-week trip to France, and maybe we're going to pick up a chateau while we're there. And, oh, yeah, one of our daughters, she's got a new boyfriend that we want to have oft, and that'll cost some money getting that person on Silk Road. All that kind of stuff. Financial planning. There are companies here in town that are doing it. It's interestingly, you've got those giants up there in Chicago, the 800-pound gorillas, but you've got some of them right here in this area, Bloomington and Normal, who are stepping into this field of wealth management, working with people who have money to make sure that they still have money down the road, that they're not going to fritter it away, and that they're going to achieve the things that they want as they grow older and all of that. And there is one last field that I should mention, insurance. Insurance is hot as hell. It is just a booming field. And one of the nice things, when you're looking for career directions, look for a career path where the demographic of the people working in the field is aging. So insurance, you've got this whole raft of people who came through maybe 20, 30 years ago, and now they're getting pretty decrepit. You know, some of them, they're going to the office wearing diapers and stuff like that. So now we have to bring in, they are rapidly trying to bring in new people, and they are paying the money to do it. Here at this institution, if you belong to the insurance fraternity, insurance companies hand out money just for you to be in the fraternity and all of that. This is what finance is all about. It's actually a wide-ranging field. We compete realistically, we compete with accounting. Accounting tries to sell its people as, oh, we can do all of this kind of stuff. You don't need to hire finance people. And then we burn their buildings down or something like that when they say that. But we compete with the accounting people who say we are the ones you should be going to because we can do all of the stuff that those finance people can do. Matter of fact, you'll see a lot of ads in the big journal, trade journals, wanted, financial analyst, must have degree in accounting. You know, what the hell, man? You know, why don't you both have a degree in finance? So there is that rivalry there, and taking you a little ahead in the course. The investments field has changed dramatically. The decision-making is being done by machines and programs now. And it was always the case that the markets were efficient. And I'll talk about market efficiency in it maybe even a little bit today. But now it's to the point where if you are sitting at home, you're one of those people who thinks, oh, I'm going to look at stocks and bonds, and I'm going to maybe even do some day trading, and I'll make my own decisions on my investments, and I'll find what's a good investment. I'll listen to the Financial News Network and see what those experts have to say about what's undervalued and all that. Don't waste your time. You can't beat the market. You never really could, because at any given day, there were millions of traders with information pouring at them from unbelievable numbers of resources. The average investor could not jump to an undervaluation fast enough to take advantage of it. It's just what would never have happened. But now it's even worse. We have investment houses that not only can see much better where a stock price is going to go. One of those investment firms can now see into the future. It can see a few milliseconds into the future. It can look ahead, and it can see where you investors are going to be, and it can get to a watering hole before you even make your trade. That's how it is now. So if you think you're going to learn or get some information so that you can beat the market, dream on. You can't beat something that is looking into the future. You just can't. Sounds like science fiction? It ain't. It's real. It's also probably illegal. It's just a weird version of front running. But our government doesn't care anymore. Not when the campaign contributions come from Wall Street. Corporate finance is the heavy where you are in the company, as I said. You're making the decisions the day-to-day, not just about what projects to accept, but also because there's money that a company is taking in every day, money that's going out every day, and there has to be some way to make decisions about how do we deal with this money, these cash flows. If I'm going to have $1 million in a bank the company bank account, I can just sort of sit there and let it earn nothing, or I can figure out some way that I can extract a few bucks off it while it's sitting there before I have to spend it on something. So corporate finance isn't just about projects. I should have made that clear. Let me get down to some basics. You've all had an economics course, right? Okay. I am a financial economist. I teach economics. It's too bad you didn't have it from me, because you would have had it from the best if you'd had it from me. But I'll try to make up for that right now. Well, let me do this. You are a bread maker. You make bread. Now, you're the only bread maker in town. Now, as the only bread maker in town, that means that you can pretty much charge whatever the market can bear. You can hurt the customers. You can also be quite wasteful with your resources. You're going to put flour in to make bread. You know, got a lot on the floor, like that. You can hire your lazy-ass brother here who sits in the basement eating Cheetos, playing World of Warcraft, waiting for mom to make him his grilled cheese. Who cares? Just higher cost, just pass it on to the customers. Because there's no one else doing this bread making in town. Something about human nature just doesn't like that. Whenever there is someone who doesn't deserve to make money, there is a desire to take that money away from that person. Now, it might be you, or you might be one of, no, I don't want to hurt no one's feelings, but it might be you. She's driving around town in a nice car. I know, right? You know? But, I mean, she's making the money. So all you would really have to do is to go into the bread business and stop wasting resources. You don't pour flour and waste it on the floor. You don't hire people you don't need. That's called static efficiency. Static efficiency is moving toward efficient use of resources. And as your costs go down, you can then charge a lower price to your customers. And that is not because you love people. You want them to have nutritious bread at a good price. Oh, we say that all the time. Of course we say that. We lie. You want that because you want money. You want to take her business away from her. And the way you did it was to just be more efficient in your use of resources. Static efficiency. But the story doesn't end there. Because you see him doing his thing. Yeah, he's really careful with the way he uses that flour. He hires the minimum number of people. But you see, there's a spark in human nature that still wants it. And that spark drives people to think of a different way to do things. And when you talk about a different way to do things, what you're talking about is a technological change. Now, you hear this word technology in your lives, and it always has to do with computers. Technology in your home, technology in the classroom, technology in your ass. No, technology is how you arrange factors of production and apply them to resources to create output. That's what technology is. Technology is as old as we are. As a matter of fact, there are animals that have technologies. So what you think of is, okay, maybe more machinery, fewer people. Or maybe more people, fewer machines. Or maybe arranging the workflow environment in a different way, significantly. Or maybe a different kind of machine. That's all a technological change that will make it more efficient to produce the output. That's called dynamic efficiency. Dynamic efficiency. Using technological change to create resource efficiency. And then your costs go down so your price can go down. Again, first, you are not doing this because you love people and you want them to have a product at a good price. We'll say that, sure. But the reason you are doing it is because you are greedy. You son of a bitch. You are out doing technological innovation, saving resources, bringing your prices down because you want to drive him out of business, put her into bankruptcy so their kids have to go to Illinois State University. Oh, God, I'm podcasting this. You understand that in our world, greed is not a bad thing. Greed is good. Greed drives efficiency. Greed makes you use your private property in the most efficient way possible so that you can make a buck. You're taking risks doing it. That's what entrepreneurial skill, that's what equity is all about, is taking a risk, bringing together the factors of production, applying a technology to create an output. And you're doing it because you can make money. But here's the other side of it. Well, you say, oh, the world's going to hell if everyone's greedy. Okay, you got your bread shop up. You're selling your bread at low prices. You put up a giant sign that says, my bread tastes like ass. Mom tried to take her boy in there. No, Mommy, I don't want that bread. That bread tastes like ass. Oh, shut up. There are kids starving in China who'd love to have an ass sandwich right about now. You can't sell the bread if it makes people's breath smell like ass. Okay, maybe Chicago niche market, whatever. But look, you can't lower the quality so much that your customers walk away. They'll go back to him and pay a higher price so that they don't have butt breath. You understand that the greed has a stop on it. The market has a regulator that keeps you from doing too much to make money. So as technological innovation takes hold, as static efficiency bites in, as technological innovation, dynamic efficiency comes to bear, there's always that market out there, the demand side that says enough is enough. Don't make it so cheap that it kills us, that it doesn't satisfy our need. Taking that into account, though, again, we cannot live in a world where we think that greed is an evil. Greed drives us to efficiency. Greed drives us to excellence. I got two grades left, an A and an F. I got one for him and one for you. Which one do you want? Your call. Oh, you mean, mean bastard. Greed drives us. Want, hunger. Hunger for life, hunger for food, hunger for toys, hunger for health. Do you like sex?
Much of the next guy does. Oh.
Man card issue. We don't apologize for what we are. We are the animal that stands on two legs and goes out there and makes the world different. Sometimes we screw up. Yeah, the global warming, we're all going to drown in a flood, whatever. But look, the point being that we don't apologize, first of all, for greed, and also we assume greed is driving the markets, driving decision making. It's either you have it or someone else has it. As time goes on, we build the economy so we all have more. But at any given flashpoint in time, we have to assume in all of the modeling that I'm going to do in this class that the underlying motivation isn't love. It isn't desire for a better world for everyone and all that. It's greed. Imagine down the road, you have lived an incredibly good life, son. Look at me instead of that stupid-ass computer. You've lived a wonderful, good life. You have done for the poor. You've taken care of people. You made money, but you didn't even take care of your own health. You gave to hungry kids. You helped the elderly. You gave up great jobs and good money so that you could be a fine, good man. And then, near the end of your life, something happens. Something terrible happens. You're in a dream one night, and you hear angels. Hosanna! And a figure comes out, my son. Thou hast lived the good life. Thou hast done for the poor. Thou hast been a faithful and honorable servant to me. And as you expected, there was a reward after this in heaven. I lied! You're going to hell! Sorry, sucker! Now I'll give you a chance to live your life over again. Screw the poor. You understand that everything we do has a self-motivation in this life or the next. No matter how we make decisions, there is something in it for us that does not discount honor. I saw honor in the service, men who died saving other people. But in the normal course of human events, you are all greedy, and I have to assume that you will do whatever you can to make yourself better off, even if that is at the expense of others. That's just how the world has to work for our modeling purposes. That doesn't mean that there aren't great people in this world, but at the end of the day, we can't assume your intentions. We can assume only your capabilities. In our financial modeling of the world, the way we model the world in finance and economics, we have this concept called profit. Profit, I'll use the word, I you'll see me try to avoid that word, because that word carries with it a notion that is useless to us in finance and in economics. Profit is your is an accounting concept. Your revenues minus your costs. That's profit. But you see, you particularly, and you're no different from a company in this regard, profit really isn't the motivator. As greedy as we can assume we are, profit is not the goal of our greed. Value is the goal. Value is not the same as profit. Profit is just an accounting rule base. It comes as a result of an accounting rule base. Value is something that is deeper. Value carries with it three concepts that we can quantify. In other words, we can put numbers to them, although a really good financial analyst, and I'm going to talk about this, how to take you beyond just the technicals. There's more to it than just always just putting numbers on things. I'm going to mention that again in a second here. But value has to do with the level of future expected cash flows. Future expected cash flows. It has to do with the timing of those future expected cash flows. And it has to do with the risk that is being taken for those expected future cash flows. Let me make this easy. I'll make this easy. Madam, would you rather have, I got a $20 bill and a $100 bill. Which one do you want?
$100 bill.
God, greed. I don't know what's come of you kids. Yeah, level. Level matters. Higher, better, lower, not better. That's all there is to it. Simple. Timing. Can give you $100 today, or I'll give you $100 in 5 years.
Right now, 5 seconds.
Right here, son. Boy, right here. Yeah. Timing. See how easy it is. It's easy. Risk. Woman. I actually do know how to get up to the top of the State Farm Hall of Business here. Tell you what, if you go up there with me and you jump off the roof, I'll give you a buck. What? It's a dollar. It's like a free dollar. Just jump. Hey, what the hell? You know, it's a buck. Here, see? It's got Washington on it. Yeah, see? No one's even drawn a mustache on him. He looked better with a mustache. See? A dollar. Let's go. You ready? Why not? Woman, I have to teach a class. I don't have time to be bleeding, okay? You'll bounce. I mean, at risk. You see, there are some things that carry more risk than other things. And if you're going to take more risk, now you don't know you're going to get a better expected return, but you should expect a better return if you are going to take more risk. You are not going to walk into a risky situation, okay, unless you're doing the movie Jackass, but you're not going to normally walk into a highly risky situation for the purpose of making just a little bit of money. That's a rock-solid rule. And so one of the things that amazes me about these financial guru programs, Financial News Network, this fund manager earned a 28% return last year on his investment portfolio. Isn't he a fantastic human being? That's the stupidest ass thing in the world, because that fund manager, if you look at the risk that he took with people's money, you'll find out that that SOB was hanging those people out on a limb for that money. So he is no hero. He was taking a whole hell of a lot of risk for what he was doing. I would be more impressed with someone who took less risk, who pulled a decent return, and didn't put people's financial futures in jeopardy. You see, that's the thing about it. is that they don't talk about risk, but risk is, you weren't going to jump off that. I mean, if it had been, just step out the door, you would have taken the buck and done it. There wasn't any risk. But jumping off the fourth floor, I mean, I try to get some squirrels over there to soften your fall when you hit, but, probably wouldn't have worked. You see, risk is a driving force in our lives. And one of the first things that you will, you should write down, the greater the risk, the greater the expected return. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. It is a driving force in our lives, in our businesses, and in the rise and fall of civilizations. Here at this school, madam, there are a lot of people who graduate from here who can't get a job. You're on the hook. By the end of this, you've probably spent $100,000 on this education. You actually spent a lot more than that, and we'll talk about that in a minute. You might not get a job. But if you do, you'll make a salary that would be better than you did with just a high school diploma. You are taking a risk, not because you are guaranteed a higher return, but because you expect a higher return. The truth of the matter is, in your case, you're going to end up being the assistant manager at a Jiffy Lube on the outskirts of Toledo. It's a decent living. And on the weekends, you do Elvis impersonations for children's parties, and you're damn good at it. And you hooked up with a biker named Ed, who's really nice. The tattoos really don't reveal his inner softness. Look, though, that's why you're here. You're bearing a risk. You're taking a risk because you expect to get something out of that risk. Otherwise, you could have just come right out of high school and gotten a job at McDonald's or something like that. So you're living this value model. You are enhancing value. And that's what we do in business. That's our entire goal in business, is enhancing shareholder, that is owner value in the corporation or in the business. I should mention a little more about myself. I am a professor. I have been for 34 years, but I'm also a business person. I run my own corporation. For years, I was a business consultant. I expected to make a lot of money at it. I knew there were risks, but I didn't grasp how incredible, insane the risks were. And I almost got killed, and I almost went to prison. Fortunately, the statute of limitations is out, so knock it off with thinking you're going to turn me into the feds, damn you. But the risk was phenomenal, and the risk was so high that the return that I was expecting just wasn't worth it in the end. Now I run a corporation. The risks in that are small, comparatively speaking, but they are staggering for what I do. Buying inventory and hoping the hell that I can sell it? Are you kidding me? You know what? I expected to sell it. I didn't. I'm getting creamed this year. That's the risk that goes along with the expected return. There you go. But the whole point, again, is that accounting deals with historical information. What has already happened? What is on paper that we can document has happened? In finance, as in economic behavior of all of you, the past is gone. It's dead. What matters is what's to come. You might have been an athlete in high school, the captain of the football team.
No.
Oh, I know. I can. But what matters now is what you're going to become. Not what you were. And that's the whole thing in finance. And that's what separates us from accounting, is that we look to what is coming to enhance our value now. And so your credentials, as you're building them now, is evidence of the value that you would have to a company that hires you. The truth of the matter is, when a company hires you, when you get your degree, there was a manager, I took my finance students down to St. Louis last year to a big, big company down there, and he just bluntly told my students, he said, look, if we hire you, you're not going to make us a dime for the first 18 to 24 months. And he said, we're going to end up spilling about $250,000 into you before you even start to make money for us. But we're going to hire you anyway, based upon what we see as the value in you now from our expectations of your future expected cash flows to the corporation, to our company. He put it to him, put it to everyone bluntly. It was like, your degree is just the beginning of the journey, but the degree showing that you did this is evidence not of profit, but of value in you. So that's why we care about in finance about value, and the accounting concepts just are kind of irrelevant to us. Now let me take this a step further and talk to you about costs. As I said, in accounting, by the rules that they have to follow in order to create that consistency that is so essential to accounting, the reliability of accounting information, their rules require that they look at historical costs, and it has to be a documented cost. You have to show me this happened already. But you see, in economics and finance, we can't care about historical costs. We'll use them as a proxy to see where costs are going. No question about that. But they are not the costs that are really important to us when we get to the end of the day. In finance, there are, and economics in general, there are direct costs and there are indirect costs. The costs that are direct are the ones that are going to come straight out of your pocket. If you are here at Illinois State University, you're going to spend about $21,000. Is it $21,000 now? For a year of college, okay? You're going to sit in classes and do studying and eventually, let's hope, get your degree. Like I'm going to pass any. You're going to eventually get a degree. The direct cost is $21,000. Now let's talk realistically. You could get a job right now. You could quit college and get a job for $10, okay, in your case, $8 an hour. You could. The fact that you are choosing to be in my class instead of out there working means that you are giving up money. You are surrendering it. That when you go home and study, you could be at a job instead. When you are sleeping, you could instead be at a job. When you are on the toilet taking a crap, you could be at a job. Well, I have to take a crap, man, and I have to sleep. No doubt about it. I don't want to see you groggy and full. But that doesn't mean that you have not given up money. That's why one of our dominating costs is the opportunity cost. The cost of the best alternative for God. The cost of the best alternative for God. Whenever you do anything in this life, you are giving up something else that you could have done instead that would have made you money. This is the axiom. Nothing is free. Nothing. I hear someone, well, love is free. No, man, I was in the Army, $25. $35 if you didn't want ugly. I saved the $10 for the Grand Slams at Denny's. Shut up. Look, nothing is free, you see. And that we have to think of. When you take on this project, what project are you giving up? That becomes a cost of this project. When you take this and get this college education, what did you give up? Something. a job that you could have done instead of this. So you are really rolling the dice, because not only are you throwing money out directly, but you're throwing money out opportunity cost-wise. Let me show you how this works in actual practice. We see it all around us, all the time. The decision-making driven by this hidden, indirect opportunity cost. Let's say, madam, you get a job at State Barn. You're going to make $50 an hour. You're good. $50, that's good. You, on the other hand, it just didn't work out for you. You know, there was that arrest and then that girl who wasn't 18. And I know, right? But, you know, so the best you could do is $10 an hour. But you did get a 25-cent an hour raise. It was $9.75 when you started 4 years ago. Yeah, living the dream. That's what we're about here at Illinois State. Okay. Okay, now let's talk. You go to the stores here in town. You notice that there are, if you haven't noticed, you probably have, there are so many different grocery stores. There's the low-end stores. And then there are the high-end stores. Now, the low-end stores, there's Walmart and Aldi's. I hate Aldi's. They make you pay for your shopping cart. They put your food in boxes on the floor. Walmart, where you can get low, low prices every day. And then you got the high-priced stores, like the Schnucks, the Fresh Market. But the products are very much the same. Schnucks and Walmart have pretty much the same products. It's just that you pay more at Schnucks. Why would anyone go to Schnucks? Well, that's pretty easy. Because, you see, let's talk about Walmart. Let's go to Walmart. Okay, everyone, we're going to go to Walmart. Okay. First of all, you have to find parking. Yeah, in the next county. Then you have to walk through the parking lot and you almost get run over by some prairie hillbilly in a giant truck that has a bumper sticker that says, "My wife, yes, my dog, maybe, my gun, never." And then you walk in the door and you hear underneath you, "Hi, welcome to Walmart." "Oh, Jesus, they're hiring midgets as greeters." And then you walk down the aisles and there is a double-wide wife is there in the aisle calling you to find out what you want for dinner, and you can't get around her. You finally find what you want after you've used GPS to locate it in the big store, and you go up to the line and it's 13 people deep. Right in front of you is a cart full of kids, and the little snot is looking at you with his finger and his nose staring at you. Clear up in the front of the line, Granny is using a debit card for the first time. Oh, my. That was 9 times, and it didn't work. You know, lady, hurry up and get by your groceries. You're old. You're going to die. Go home. Eat something before you go to your next your great reward. And the kind of people who shop there, they are the people who were thrown out of Decatur. I gotta stop that. My mom lives in Decatur. Yes, I know. I met her at a parking lot in a truck stop. You spend an extra 30 minutes at Walmart. 30 minutes. To get your groceries. If you go into Schnucks, you just walk in there, get your stuff, and go to the cart, check out, and you're done. 30 extra minutes at the Walmart. Let's talk about a half of an hour, what that costs you. A half of an hour at Walmart for the $10 an hour worker, that costs you $5 in wait time. But you, $50 an hour worker at State Barn, that half an hour costs you $25. You would be willing to spend as much as an extra $20 for a grocery cart load of groceries at Schnucks. The rich people have a higher opportunity cost of time, so you can charge them more to save them money. You actually save money because your opportunity cost of time is so high. That's why if you've ever gone to Six Flags or Disney World, you don't see rich people standing in lines. They pay money to cut the lines. You did know that. You can pay a lot of money. When I was a consultant, the rich boys that I ran with, they paid the money, and we got to go right to the front of the lines. They were members of Club 33. See, you'll pay money just to avoid standing in a line. Think about it. Young people, it's rational for a young person to sit in the basement playing games all night long. Why? Because his opportunity cost of time is so low. What kind of a good paying job can he have? Of course he's going to sit in his basement. You see, losers and tweakers and all manner of people from the northwest suburbs of Chicago at the drag races because they can sit there all day drinking, getting blattoed. Poor people will go and do criminal activities because their opportunity cost of time is lower. So for a rich person, it costs a lot more to spend time in prison than for a poor person. So, of course, we're going to fill our prisons with the poor people and let the rich people off the hook because the poor people, what else are they going to do with their lives? They're poor. Isn't that hateful? That's the reality of it. Okay, that's opportunity cost. Now, let's talk about some other costs that are not going to be part of it. Sunk cost. If you've already... Okay. Madam, you bought a portfolio of stock, spent $100, big time, $100 on a portfolio of stock. Now, you come to me a year later. Professor, you're a financial kind of person. This stock I bought, I spent $100 and now it's $10. Okay? So you're an investment genius. The next thing is, well, what should I do? Okay, well, let me ask you this. What would you like to do with that? What would you like to have happen? Well, yeah, that's exactly right. And I hear this, I don't want to hear it anymore. I'm going to hold on to it until I make get my $100 back. Okay. The next question is, and this is a challenge question for you. Where is that $100? It's with Jesus. It's in heaven. There is no $100. It does not exist anywhere in the universe. It's gone. You bought a cocktail for a rich pig on Wall Street, and he has urinated it out. That's the reality of it. And I say it like that just to give people the clear understanding of what you do when you invest and you lose money. It's gone. You've got $10 now. So your decision on what to do is going to be based upon whether or not you think that portfolio is going to rise or fall from $10. Money already spent is gone forever. As a consultant, I help small companies go public and stay public. And we would talk about projects. We had a project in this one company. And I'll phony up the numbers a little bit. They'd already put in about $2.5 million. To finish the project, they had gone through phase one. To finish the project, they needed to put in another $500,000. And I just threw it to them. Well, what are you going to do? Well, you know, we've already put all this money into it. We got to keep going. No. The only reason you keep going is if $500,000 is going to make you any money. The it was more than that, actually. But it has nothing whatsoever to do with the decision now. There is no past. It's gone. It has gone away forever. Now, I can even prove this, you think this way, you don't want to think this way, but you actually do. Sir, it's 20 years from now. You've gotten your degree here. You have a really good job, and you have a nice McMansion in the suburbs, and you've been married to this beautiful woman for 20 years. Now, every night, it's the same thing. You come in, the lights are on. She always gets home a little before you. She lights some candles, and she plays your favorite song, and you walk in, and you dance for a while, and then you laugh, and you have some nuke and puke, and then you do the wild thing. And then, you know, at that age, no, you don't, but not after the first 6 months. But, okay, here's the deal. Okay, one night, finally, after 20 years, you walk in and the hallway is dark. There's silence everywhere. Honey, I'm home. And suddenly at the other end of the hallway, she steps out in a Soviet-era uniform with a Kalashnikov rifle. And she unloads 20 rounds right at you. Bah, 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 bah. You drop to the ground and you crawl out. You run towards the car. It's thunder in the sky. You get to the car. She screams, "Come back here, asshole!" You manage to pull out and the thunder rolls. And the lightning strikes. And you get away. You screech down the street and you finally get down to another part of the housing subdivision, and the rain is falling. And then you turn on the radio. There's tears in your eyes. Oh, my God, they're playing your song on the radio. You are so beautiful to me. Can't you see? Now, you're crying. Do you go back? And make it say, "Oh, okay." 20 years, there were 20 rounds that hit the wall. That's only one round a year. Are you going to go back? Hell no. History doesn't matter. It's your expectation of the future that matters. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.